You're a podcast listener, and this is a podcast ad. Reach great listeners like yourself with podcast advertising from Lips and Ads. Choose from hundreds of top podcasts offering host endorsements, or run a reproduced ad like this one across thousands of shows to reach your target audience with Lips and Ads. Go to lipsandads.com now. That's LIBSYNads.com.
Welcome to the Kottke Ride Home for Friday, October 8th, 2021. I'm Jackson Bird. Today, the winners of the Nobel Peace Prize have been announced, as well as the winners in chemistry and literature. More on each winner, as well as a question about whether we really need the Nobel Prize. Plus, the remnants of the oldest black church in the U.S. have been uncovered in Colonial Williamsburg. And a Google AI has recreated famous works of art by Gustav Klimt that were lost in World War II. Here are some of the cool things from the news today. The winners of the Nobel Peace Prize were announced this morning, and we also learned the winners of the literature and chemistry prizes over the last few days. The prize in economic sciences is still to come this Monday, but here's everyone else who has won thus far. Earlier this week, I told you more about the work of the winners of medicine and physics, David Julius and Artem Patapushin for medicine, and Soyokuro Manabe, Klaus Hasselmann, and Giorgio Parisi for physics. So go back and listen to Tuesday's episode if you want to learn more about them. But on Wednesday, the Nobel Prize in Chemistry was awarded to Benjamin List and David W.C. McMillan for their work on a tool to build molecules. Quoting the New York Times, their work has spurred advances in pharmaceutical research and allowed scientists to construct catalysts with considerably less impact on the environment. The process developed by Dr. List and Dr. McMillan, while unseen by consumers, has led to a gold rush in the field, the Nobel Committee wrote. Known as organocatalysis, it has helped those who apply chemistry to real-world problems to build more precise catalysts that reduce waste and streamline the production of existing pharmaceuticals. Since Dr. List's and Dr. McMillan's concurrent discoveries, the two scientists and other researchers have designed a plethora of molecules used in drugs, agrochemicals, and efficient, durable materials. Their research has also sped up the production of existing pharmaceuticals, such as antidepressant paroxetine and the antiviral oseltamivir, which treats respiratory infections, the committee wrote. End quote. Then, on Thursday, the Nobel Prize in Literature went to Abdelrazak Gurna, a Tanzanian author whose 10 novels and many short stories tend to focus on themes of colonialism and the experiences of refugees. Now, writers are often the most recognizable winners, second probably only to the Peace Prize winners, but if you've never heard of Gurna before, you're not alone. His editor, Alexandra Pringle, said of him, quote, "He is one of the greatest living African writers, and no one has ever taken any notice of him, and it just killed me." End quote. Quoting further from The Guardian, Pringle said Gurna had always written about displacement, but in the most beautiful and haunting ways of what it is that uproots people and blows them across continents. It's not always asylum seeking. It can be so many reasons. It can be trade. It can be commerce. It can be education. It can be love, she said. The first of his novels I took on at Bloomsbury is called By the Sea, and there's this haunting image of a man at Heathrow Airport with a carved incense box, and that's all he has. He arrives and he says one word, and that's asylum. Maya Yagi, critic and 2021 Costa Prize judge, said Gurna is a powerful and nuanced writer whose elliptical lyricism counters the silences and lies of imperial history imposed when he was a child in East Africa. His subtle oeuvre is as robust about the brutal flaws of the mercantile culture he left as the atrocities of British and German colonialism, not least during the First World War, and the random acts of terror he experienced as a black person in Britain, converting them into a comic triumph in his 1988 novel Pilgrim's Way. End quote. And finally, early this morning, Eastern Time, we learned the winners of the coveted Nobel Peace Prize, and they were Maria Ressa and Dmitry Muratov, two journalists from the Philippines and Russia, respectively, who have fought to protect freedom of expression from authoritarian regimes. Quoting the official Nobel announcement, Dmitry Muratov has for decades defended the freedom of speech in Russia under increasingly challenging conditions. In 1993, he was one of the founders of the independent newspaper Novaya Gazeta, the most independent newspaper in Russia today, with a fundamentally critical attitude towards power. The newspaper's fact-based journalism and professional integrity have made it an important source of information on censurable aspects of Russian society rarely mentioned by other media. Since its startup in 1993, Novaya Gazeta has published critical articles on subjects ranging from corruption, police violence, unlawful arrests, electoral fraud, and troll factories to the use of Russian military forces both within and outside Russia. Since the newspaper's start, six of its journalists have been killed. Despite the killings and threats, editor-in-chief Muratov has refused to abandon the newspaper's independent policy. He has consistently defended the right of journalists to write about anything they want, about whatever they want, as long as they comply with the professional and ethical standards of journalism. End quote. And of Maria Ressa, the Washington Post wrote, quote, Ressa is the chief executive of the Rappler news website, which she co-founded in 2011 after covering Southeast Asia for 2 decades for CNN. Under the administration of Philippine President Rodrigo Duterte, Ressa herself and her news organization have repeatedly been targeted through campaigns of online harassment and criminal charges, which have been widely seen as politically motivated. Time magazine named her, along with other journalists, a Person of the Year in 2018. 10 arrest warrants were issued for her in less than 2 years, and she is fighting 9 separate cases. Throughout, she has remained a staunch advocate of freedom of the press. After her conviction last year, she said the case was not about Rappler, but about every Filipino, because freedom of the press is the foundation of every single right you have as a Filipino citizen, she said, end quote. Ressa has also been outspoken about misinformation campaigns, specifically those spread on Facebook, of which she has been particularly critical. In an interview about her win today, Ressa said, quote, "When we live in a world where facts are debatable, where the world's largest distributor of news prioritizes the spread of lies laced with anger and hate and spreads it faster and further than facts, then journalism becomes activism." End quote. Ressa is the sole woman to win a Nobel Prize this year so far, and only the 18th woman ever in the prize's 126-year history, 7 of those wins coming just in the 21st century. The Nobel Committee has said they're working towards being less male-oriented and Eurocentric, but it seems to be slow going. In a critique of the Nobel Prize being bad for science in general, biologist Devang Mehta points out that no black people have ever won a science Nobel Prize. Sir William Arthur Lewis won for economics in 1979, 4 black writers have won the prize in literature, including Gurna this year, and 12 black leaders have won the Peace Prize, but that's still only 17 black people in over a century across 6 categories. Further, Mehta shares that the US and the UK have by far won the most Nobel Prizes, with Germany and France close behind. Japan is the only country to have won more than 10, unless you also count Russia, but still, the winners are definitely skewed towards certain places and populations. Which is all, like, you know, kind of fine in and of itself, if the prize wasn't treated as basically the top merit on Earth. The problem, as Mehta sees it, particularly for science, is that the Nobel Prizes imply that just one individual or a small team of people are responsible for huge innovations and discoveries, when that's rarely the case. There are usually far more people who worked with them over the years, and even more people whose work they built off of. When just a handful of people get acknowledged for a breakthrough, and that's what we record in the history books, it implies that science is a field of competition and not one of collaboration. And we need that collaboration for true progress to happen. Here's one proposed solution from Mehta, quote, "You could have Nobels going to discoveries so that you have a Nobel Prize, for example, for the invention of the mRNA vaccine, without actually saying who made that discovery. And then you could even have the prize money go into a fund to do research on that topic. But maybe that fund could be given to people working in developing countries, because that's where you need more resources. And that could be a way in which you still have the publicity of science. You still have the discoveries in science going out to the world every year through the Nobels, but you don't have this kind of distortion of what science actually looks like." End quote. An interesting proposal. And on the note of the mRNA vaccine technology, I and many others expressed some disappointment that none of the work done to develop the COVID-19 vaccines, and especially the decades-long work on mRNA technology that was finally realized in some of those vaccines, was recognized by the Nobel Committee. Now, Nature pointed out that this is in part because the timing wasn't exactly right. Nominations were due by February 1st, and while vaccine rollout had begun by then, the real impact on the pandemic had not yet been seen, and in some ways is still happening. Also, the time between a discovery, so to speak, happening and a prize being awarded keeps growing. Right now, it actually averages about 30 years. And while Nature notes the first experimental mRNA vaccines were tested in the mid-1990s, a lot of the other advances didn't happen until the early 2000s, and you could even make an argument that we didn't see the real success of them until this pandemic, or maybe even not yet. And there's also the fact that the committee likes to award breakthroughs that have impacts in more than just one area. And while there's a ton of promise for mRNA technology to completely revolutionize vaccinations and help save countless lives from a whole host of different diseases, we're not quite there yet. Most people in the know, however, seem pretty confident that a Nobel Prize is definitely coming down the line at some point if mRNA vaccine tech continues to be as revolutionary as it seems to be now. Just ping me when Catalin Carrico wins her Nobel Prize. That's all I'm waiting for. The foundation of the oldest black church in the United States has been uncovered beneath a parking lot for Colonial Williamsburg. And the irony of part of this nation's Revolutionary War era history having to be uncovered by an archaeological dig when it's already on the site of the number one living history museum of that exact era is not lost on those involved. Even though black residents made up more than half of the population of Williamsburg at the time, they were only included in any content at Colonial Williamsburg starting in 1979, and even then, barely at all. The archaeological dig to uncover the original site of the First Baptist Church has been ongoing for a couple of years, spearheaded by members of the church who want their stories told and history preserved. Quoting the Associated Press, "The First Baptist Church was formed in 1776 by free and enslaved black people. They initially met secretly in fields and under trees in defiance of laws that prevented African Americans from congregating. By 1818, the church had its first building in the former colonial capital. The 16-foot by 20-foot structure was destroyed by a tornado in 1834. The First Baptist's second structure, built in 1856, stood there for a century, but an expanding Colonial Williamsburg bought the property in 1956 and turned it into a parking lot. First Baptist pastor Reginald F. Davis, whose church now stands elsewhere in Williamsburg, said the uncovering of the church's first home is a rediscovery of the humanity of a people. This helps to erase the historical and social amnesia that has afflicted this country for so many years," he said. End quote. Until the dig began last year, the only acknowledgement of the church that used to stand on the site of the parking lot was a small plaque. Now, Colonial Williamsburg has announced that they've identified the brick foundation of the church, a handful of artifacts, and at least 25 burial sites. As Wired wrote in a piece last year when the dig began, quote, "What's happening with First Baptist isn't unique. The past gets unearthed constantly. Archaeology exists as a scientific study focused on excavating historic remains to explain human life. Going all the way back to the Enlightenment, the idea has been that science is neutral, rational. But archaeology, like any discipline, is profoundly intertwined with ideology. Which histories get written and which artifacts get collected and preserved has largely been decided by those in power, who saw their version of events as canon. Put less nicely, the field is as rooted in white supremacy as anything else in America." End quote. Connie Matthews-Harshaw, a member of the First Baptist Church and president of the Let Freedom Ring Foundation, which preserves the church's history, told Wired that the church has been working closely with Colonial Williamsburg and is pushing for a reconstruction of the church to be created, saying, quote, "We've made our position clear to Colonial Williamsburg. We're saying, not this time. You're not going to tell the story for us this time." End quote. So this is pretty cool. Google's Arts and Culture Lab used machine learning to recreate some of Gustav Klimt's paintings that were burned by Nazis in 1945. Now, Nazis held burnings of many artworks and book and research collections, notably Alfred Hirschfeld's Institute for Sexual Science. In the case of Klimt's paintings, they were being held with many other works of art in a castle called Schloss Immendorf in Austria, where Nazis had been storing them after stealing them. On the last day of World War II, the castle burnt down, and it's presumed the fire was started intentionally by the retreating Nazis. All that remains of Klimt's paintings that were stored there are black and white photographs. But now, Google has teamed up with the Belvedere Museum in Vienna to recreate what the paintings would have looked like in full color. Quoting Mashable, researchers took inputs from several sources to create an algorithm that would color the paintings in ways Klimt experts believe could be accurate representations of the originals. One source was newspaper reports that described the colors, such as a vibrant green for the sky in philosophy. The other was Klimt's works created around the same time. The result for me was surprising because we were able to color it even in the places where we had no knowledge. With machine learning, we have good assumptions that Klimt used certain colors, Dr. Franz Smola, curator at the Belvedere Museum, said in a statement provided by Google. End quote. The recreated works are included as part of an online hub from Google focused on the life and work of Gustav Klimt called Klimt vs. Klimt. The hub is themed around the contradictions of the artist, both in his personal life and his artistic style. It's a pretty cool kind of virtual exhibit, and you know, I always forget about Google Arts and Culture. And there is so much fascinating stuff to explore on that site and app. It's kind of like visiting an interactive museum from your sofa. Strong recommend for a weekend activity. Well, here's kind of what I've been waiting for all week. The FBI has officially rebuked the claims of the Case Breakers group who claimed to have identified the Zodiac Killer. The FBI said, quote, "The case remains open and there is no new information to report," end quote. Another independent Zodiac investigator, Tom Voigt, who runs ZodiacKiller.com, told Rolling Stone that the Case Breakers claim was, quote, "completely bogus," and, quote, "hot garbage." Now, why believe one independent Zodiac killer sleuth over a whole team of others? I mean, who knows? Take it with a grain of salt, do more research, and come to your own opinion. But Voigt brought up some of the things that had seemed fishy to me about the Case Breakers' claims, namely that a big part of their argument was that the man they accused had some kind of forehead scar that matched the lines on the forehead of the Zodiac killer in the infamous sketch of him. Quoting Voigt, "No witness ever described lines on Zodiac's forehead. Those lines were simply added by the sketch artist to fill in the sketch. The amended sketch, which is supposed to look more like Zodiac, according to witnesses, doesn't really even have any lines," end quote. Voigt also says that despite having worked on this case on his own for a quarter of a century, running a website hub and publishing books on it, he had literally never heard of the Case Breakers group before this week. He's got some other really good critiques of the group, but I'll just repeat what the FBI said. The case remains open. And that is it from me for this week. As always, this show was produced by Ride Home Media and Kotke.org. I am Jackson Bird, and I will talk to you again on Monday. Actually Monday, no 3-day weekend here, but I hope you all have a great weekend, and I'll talk to you again on Monday.